Well, good morning, everybody. As everybody is getting set up, I've been asked to provide framing for this conversation. As you know, I'm here, and let me see if they can you flip to my first slide, please? That way I can remember who I am. One second. Okay. Well, while they're looking for that, I'm actually here as the president and founder of the Harris Foundation. I also am here as a founding board member for NIMSE, and we heard Matt this morning talk about NIMSE and all the great things that we're doing. And, of course, our topic, as you just heard, for this morning is about attainment and also retention. Well, we've already heard about exposure. We already heard about access. And so what we're going to do now is try to answer two questions. How do we increase the pathways for STEM degree attainment? And how can we strengthen retention in higher level education, college education, and also getting kids involved in STEM fields? There we are. Thank you. That's my first slide. So, of course, as an astronaut, I cannot stand before an audience and not show a picture of space. You know, it's just one of those things. But I show this to look backwards during the time in which I was thinking about getting into the STEM fields. I saw the lunar landing in 1969, and I, like every other kid, wanted to follow in the footsteps of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. But as was alluded to this morning, I believe Dr. Mae Jemison mentioned that she and I are, never mind, won't go there. But anyway, that when we were looking at the space program, there were also things on the television, that black and white television, where we're accomplishing some of the greatest heights in the world and going to the moon. But at the same time, we had just come out of the civil rights movement. And so that's the environment that I grew up, the environment of segregation that I grew up. What do the kids have to do now? Next slide, please. The facts that they have to deal with, of course, is that our dropout rates are extremely too high. That the exposure to STEM in education is still too low. And if we think about the future, if you go to the next slide for me. This was some facts that were put together by the National Academies. I believe it was in 2006 or so, when the National Academies brought together the CEO of ExxonMobil and the CEO of Intel to come up with a study, Rising Above the Gathering Storm. And I know that a number of you have seen this. And if I was to summarize just the results of this, they said that technology was the future of this country, and that it drives our economy, it drives our competitiveness, it drives our innovation, and it drives our workforce. So with this as our challenge this morning, I'll just talk a little bit and do a little commercial, next slide, and talk about the Harris Foundation. In 1998, we formed the Harris Foundation to focus in education, health, and wealth. And if you go to the next slide, we actually have programs all over the country. Our education programs primarily focus on STEM education. And there was a lot of discussion in the last panel about Oakland. I'm happy to say that we have partnered with Oakland and Intel in putting one of our after-school programs there. And next slide, please. And one of the programs I just want to highlight out of our programs within the Harris Foundation is a program that we held a few years ago called the Educational Forum. This was part of a larger program, our Dream Tour, where we went all across the country trying to get kids excited about math and science. And the night before, we would host forums similar to this, much smaller group, of government officials, corporations, and the like. And the last slide I'll show here is some of the results that came out of that 21-city tour. And I think as you look at this, many of you are involved in trying to solve some of the solutions that we have in STEM education for people of color. And so I suspect that during the course of our panel, a number of these items are going to be talked about. I just want to highlight the last one in terms of government. Let me applaud the White House for bringing together all of us to have these discussions Because if we don't have the government leadership that brings us together, then we have real issues. So let's give it up. And with that, I'm going to join the panel. And we're going to first do a lightning round, quick lightning round. And I'm going to ask each of you, if you will, to tell me a little bit about yourself, your program, and why you're here. You can start.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you for your very generous invitation to have the National Society of Black Engineers involved. I'm Carl Reed, Executive Director of NSBE. I just want to point out my boss, the National Chair, Matt Nelson, is here. NSBE is one of the largest student-governed societies based in the United States, with 31,000 members globally. And so I'll come back and say a few other things that I've been involved with.
So I'm Bob Moses. I work with the Algebra Project. And we're looking at the issues that algebra is available as an organizing tool in the same way that the right to vote was available as an organizing tool 50 years ago. And I'll talk some about that.
I'm Dabney Dixon. I'm a professor of chemistry and director of STEM education initiatives at Georgia State University in Atlanta. We've been one of the most successful universities in recent years at increasing the graduation and retention rates of underrepresented minorities, and I'm here to talk some about what we've done in that regard.
My name is Luke Wood, and I'm an associate professor of education at San Diego State University, and I also co-direct with Frank Harris III, the Minority Male Community College Collaborative. And we are a research and practice center that partners with community colleges to help them build their capacity to serve men of color. And so I'm here to help recenter this conversation and being inclusive of the community college context.
My name is Tony Bayless with Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the Department of Energy 17 laboratories focused on national security. It's also in the California region of Oakland. So you have another California here, but I'm also a product of the South Side of Chicago, and go Cubbies, all right, go Cubbies. As part of that, basically, I think I was invited as part of the Department of Energy's efforts to really focus on STEM. That was a collaboration with the White House as well as with Dot Harris, who has been a champion advocate of STEM, along with Secretary Moniz and Deputy Secretary Sherwood Randles, who really believe in diversity and inclusion and trying to make an impact in this light, especially within our national workforce in the government agencies.
Good morning, STEM family. I'm Barbara Y with Intel Corporation. About 2 years ago, our CEO set forth a bold commitment, which was a $300 million commitment to increasing our diversity in the workplace. And I'm fortunate, it's a blessing and also a burden, to be able to bring his vision to life along with many Intel employees.
Good morning. I am Sarah Echohawk. I'm an enrolled member of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. And I'm the CEO of the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, or ACES, as we're known. So the objective of ACES is to increase the number of American Indians in STEM. So glad to be here.
All right, thank you guys. So we're going to go through a series of questions around the challenges, around the solutions, and also retention. So let me start with Dr. Wood. Can you give us an idea of what are the challenges that you are seeing in getting youth of color into college and getting STEM degrees?
Okay. Well, when we talk about the community college context, we have to recognize that access isn't as much of an issue as success is. We know that the vast majority of our Black and Latino males, if they go to college, they're going to either start in the community college or at some point touch a community college, either by taking classes there or having some sort of experience there. So it's also important for us to understand that when we think about the traditional college student, that's not what it is at the community college. The non-traditional is the traditional. So we have students who typically delay their enrollment before going into before going into college. About half of our Black and Latino males do. So that means they're not directly transitioning from high school to college, but they're waiting. They're going into the workforce, or they're doing other things, and then they come back. And the first thing they're going to do after being out of the class about 5 to 6 years is take an assessment test in math, which is going to tell them that they're not good enough. And we think that some of the reason we see such a high proportion of them in developmental education is actually a function of the fact that there's a higher percentage of them that wait longer before going back in. We also know that many of these guys are working. About half of them go to school less than part-time, and mostly it's because they work. And the challenge is that the kind of job opportunities that are available to them are vastly different during college and after college than are for other students. So we know that there's typically little connection between what they're learning in college and then what they're doing while they're working in college. So we know that they're concentrated in jobs that have three primary characteristics. One, they're working in jobs that are physically demanding, moving boxes, digging ditches, stocking shelves, doing construction site cleanup. Second, they're doing jobs that occur late at night. So they're either working the late night shift or the overnight shift. And I can't tell you how many times when we do focus groups or interviews with men of color, one of the first things we hear is, oh yeah, I do construction site cleanup, I get off work at 3:30 a.m. Wow, that's late. What time's your first class? 8 a.m. And we also know that they're in jobs that are temporary in nature, so they're doing constant transitions between one job to the next job. So they're transitioning constantly outside of college while they're trying to transition and be successful inside of college. And if I could just point out one other thing, and I think that's been an undertone in the conversation today, but one that we also need to really point out, is some of this just deals with a lack of preparation of educators who are working with our students. We haven't, I don't think, talked enough about the mistreatment of many of our men of color and our women of color. We know from the work that we do and work done by other scholars in this room that they are treated with distress or seen with distress because of fear and criminalization. We know that they are seen with disdain because they're perceived as being lazy. I can't tell you how many times we hear people say, well, they're just here for the financial aid. And also we know that they are treated with disregard, being viewed as academically inferior. So I think it's really important for us to think about the implicit bias, the microaggressions that they're constantly facing in the classroom, and we need to stop focusing on as much of remediating the students and focus more on how can we remediate the educators that are working with them.
Now, to your point, one of our community colleges, I was told by one of the chancellors that the average number of courses or hours that a college student takes in community college is 90 hours. I don't know if that's the same. So they are working, they are taking courses, they're not being tutored along the way and counseled in the appropriate way so they can get out with 60 hours for a normal two-year degree. Dr. Dixon, same question to you, and maybe focus on how do we retain them?
So there are, I think, a variety of ways to retain folks. One of the things that we've talked about a lot today is mentoring, and I would just say that's so important, but I don't think I could possibly say it as well as the students have said it. So let me just say that that's a big part. Another part, I think, is to really think quantitatively about how we can use data analysis to help us in deciding what to do. We've had a lot of success at Georgia State in putting in a team of advisors. These are staff advisors who talk with the students and try to understand where they are and what's going on. We have a series of about 800 data points on each student, and we run the computer programs every night, and we try to figure out if the students are behind, if they're not taking the courses in the right order, maybe they're trying to sign up for something that they're really not ready for, and the advisors intervene. Last year, we had about over 50,000 one-on-one meetings between the advisors and the students. And with that, we can keep students on track to graduate at a much higher rate. It's been quite successful. And it's also cost effective, because for every student that stays for another year, at least at our place, it's about another $10,000 in fees and in tuition. And so if you multiply it all out, you can run a fairly large program and really pay a lot of attention to the students, especially in STEM fields where it's so sequenced, where you need to have freshman chemistry one before freshman chemistry two, and you need to do well enough in one before you take the next one. We've really been able to succeed in using this kind of data analysis to help get all students through, but particularly STEM students of color.
And Dr. Harris, let me just add and also establish a contrast inside corporate between mentorship and sponsorship. So I do agree that the mentorship is super important, and oftentimes even peer-to-peer mentorships are important. But what we're seeing in terms of retention of African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans inside of corporate, the sponsorship is key. And how that's distinguished is a sponsor is in the room and they're speaking to you being able to get that next job or promotion when you're not in the room. And so I want to make sure that we get that clear in terms of a distinction of how critically important for us, particularly given the small sizes that we are in these companies, that we must have sponsors in the rooms where we are not, and be very intentional about that design of how you get that sponsorship.
Yep. It's a very a challenge that most corporations have and minorities have within those corporations, is finding that appropriate sponsor. Mr. Bayless, from the Lawrence Livermore standpoint, give us your idea of the challenges.
Well, I'll piggyback on what both of my colleagues up here said, is basically, and Dr. Bob had also mentioned it as well, is this notion of power and privilege. We're not talking about it quite enough, in the sense that we need to educate the individuals that basically are in power and that are privileged, and to try to help them understand that they have biases, pure and simple. They have biases. So how do we mitigate those biases, all right, in the right way? You're not going to totally get rid of all unconscious bias that people have. It's becoming a really, you know, hot topic today, right, based on the fact that's how we've chose to accept the fact that we're basically choosing to basically say we're racist, all right? Pure and simple, all right? And that's what, you know, Dr. Wilson was talking about. People basically have been put in boxes, all right, to actually say that you're going to be educated, you're not going to be educated. It's wrong. Pure and simply wrong. We need to change that. And we need to change that as a collective body to change that. It is one of my main goals is to try to figure out how can we bond and collectively work together. I think Kimberly said it best, you know, how do we basically take all these ideas, put them in action, and make them work? And one of the challenges that I face in a research institution is really educating about the stereotypes of individuals of color that basically are perceived to not be able to cut the mustard, so to speak, all right? And how do you change that is by introducing them to them in the first place, getting them in the door. That's why I was very honored and privileged to say, okay, we're gonna take on My Brother's Keeper and basically say, we're gonna use this as a way to actually educate our audience in our own facility, all right? And then basically have them see role models like them that are there, and also have them be exposed to these young kids who have extraordinary minds, curious minds, all right? And what ended up happening was is that they basically said, this was the best thing to ever happen. We've never even gone into Oakland. Over 50 years, I've been a product transfer plant for a transplant from Chicago for 11 years. Why did it take me to come in to say we're going to do this in Chicago, you know, in Oakland and San Francisco and make it happen? Why didn't it happen before then? It makes no sense. We need to be in our communities helping each other. Now, Dr. Mae Jameson said it's also about us. We cannot put ourselves on a pedestal either. We need to basically be there, involved, and engaged. You have to be a mentor. Don't forget who you are and where you came from. You have to stay engaged with the students that are out there, and that's all students, Native American students, students we haven't talked about, students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. We need to stay engaged with all our kids in every forefront that we possibly can. And that's mean getting to know them and getting to know their parents as well.
So unless we do that as a collective body, you know, I think we're just going to keep talking, to be honest with you. That was the one thing I loved about the president and the first lady. They were real. They have stayed real for all 8 years. They went to church with my mom and my sister and brother, and I loved how they basically have kept who they are at their foundation. So that is important, that we actually understand that piece, is that we actually have to engage and be involved. Unless we do that, we're going to fail, quite simply.
Let's get the Native American perspective, Ms. Echo-Hawk. What are the challenges that you're seeing? I think we heard some of this morning.
Right. From Marissa. So I think, you know, obviously, and Marissa spoke a little bit to this too, is there is always the issue of cultural and identity. And when we're talking about American Indians, that's challenging because we're dealing with both an urban population and a reservation population. So certainly that's a challenge. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution for American Indian education or STEM. I think, you know, I've heard this said, and I like to say it, you know, if you've met one American Indian, then you've met one American Indian. So, you know, there are about 570 roughly federally recognized tribes. Each are unique with their own self-government, language, traditions, and systems. So it's challenging there. And then we have upwards of 70% of our population is now urban. So again, you're looking at those challenges. And I think one of the things that that I found in doing this work, going on about 20 years now, is that there's just not a lot of good information about American Indians. Mm-hmm. The data is not there. Even when I received the briefing for this meeting, which, by the way, was put together very well, mm-hmm. There was no data for American Indians. That's not unusual. We're usually just left out of the conversation completely or in the other category. Being 1-3% of the population in the United States, depending on which data you look at, we're just generally overlooked, and I think that is one of the biggest challenges. So I'm going to call, I'm not really calling Carl out on this, but I'm going to say, so I had the privilege of attending some of the NSBE conference last year, and we've been to the SWE conference. And I think what is so telling about those conferences is the amount of investment that companies and government agencies will make in the Society of Women Engineers and Black Engineers and Hispanic Engineers. And most often, there's exceptions. We're working with Intel and others. But a lot of times we are told, you're not big enough. So when we're looking at diversity, we as, you know, government agencies or as companies, we embrace diversity, but your numbers aren't enough. So we, and it just boggles my mind, how can you say you embrace diversity, right, but leave out the first Americans because it's a numbers issue. So I think, you know, and that was apparent when you hear Marissa speaking about, you know, we don't even know what you're talking about. Because we don't even get to have those conversations in our communities. So I don't know if, you know, that's a broad a broad challenge, but I would say that, you know, if I had to say what are the, you know, the most significance, it's access and investment for American Indians.
Thank you. Dr. Moses, you have a fan club out here, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
So in 2005, the National Academy of Sciences put forward the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report. And they were asked by Senator Lamar Alexander and some others to address the nation's concerns about STEM. So they were asked to prioritize the top 10 issues and what the nation should do about them. Their first issue was that the nation should put produce 10,000 teachers per year annually with four-year scholarships. So the Bush administration and the Obama administration just gave a Hail Mary to that. We do not have the teachers that we need. So there's more to be said, but that's the first thing. There is no policy in this country to provide the teachers that we need. And in fact, if the truth be told, both those administrations have backed what I think of as a policy abomination, Teach for America.
Okay. Well, that caused a little.
I was going to add to that, but I'm like, ooh.
I don't know what you want to add to that. I don't know if I want to step into that one or not. Let's come back to that.
Now, I will say to his point, when we look at the STEM teachers, and this is data that we know, about 40% of the teachers that are teaching STEM today do not have the certification to teach STEM. They have not been trained in STEM, yet we expect the quality of our students to exceed the quality of our students. So I think that's something that we should be thinking about.
Yeah. And if you disaggregate that by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomics, that number is probably much higher in low-income, high-minority districts that they're not trained in the disciplines. And I think some of our briefing materials really do point that out, too, that in certain districts, high minority districts, only 33% have access to calculus.
Right.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm. This is the reason why we're here. So, Barbara, since you're talking, I want to switch to solutions because we don't have a lot of time.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about the Oakland initiative that you guys are doing.
We're still talking about Oakland.
We're still talking about Oakland.
Oakland's in the house. That's all you can say.
No hate on Oakland. I reign from South Kakilaki for the local South Carolina. At any rate, let's talk about Oakland, and I'll talk about it in the context of what Intel is trying to accomplish here. So if you look at Intel's workforce, and this is how we started and how we came to Oakland. So if you look at Intel's workforce and go back to the CEO's vision, which Brian Krzanich said, Intel by 2020 will achieve full representation inside of Intel. And what that means is if the market is barren, 15% African Americans, Intel will have 50% of African American engineers or higher. Okay. If it's 27% in women, we'll have 27% or higher, and we're totally fine chasing the goal and actually trying to increase those percentages as we do this work. So given that, the biggest gaps in our workforce today lie in the areas, to no surprise to the people in this room, African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans. So therefore, Intel set on this path, sleepless nights, long hours, to pilot, innovate where we could, work with existing partners. Many of them are in this room, and I'm not going to call any out because it's like church, you'll forget somebody's name. And I'm not going to step in another thing. But we forged these deep partnerships. And I think it's also important because it came up on the panel. We were very strategic about going deep in partnerships versus being so broad and scattered that you can't measure the impact. Thus, Oakland has a great concentration of the talent that we need in the future, and we all know we have to start the access earlier. So what we're doing in Oakland, and Dr. Wilson is here and he can attest to this, so we started a partnership with Oakland. It wasn't Intel, because we do have an engineering nature to take over things. We didn't come into Oakland to take over Oakland. We sat at the table as a partner with the student at the center of the design to make sure that we had students coming out on the other side, career, from basically high school to career, so that these students that are working in Oakland now, we will gladly hire them at Intel, and we intend to match them and follow them through this continuum. And what we're doing there, we're working on two pathways in two schools, really trying to repipe and replatform the curriculum and ensuring that students get all the things that the previous panel talked about. And so Dr. Wilson will tell you the results have been positive. We're 1 year in. For the Oakland Unified School District, there's a 400% increase of the number of students that are in these CS classes. So that means in numbers, people, that we move from 683 students entering to these courses to about 2,800. And I think that's remarkable. So what I learned from that, to your point, fix the system, not the students. Fix the system, not Black people, African American people, Native Americans. And that's what we're trying to do inside of Intel. It's been hard work. You definitely have to stay persistent. We are getting resistance, that's natural. But the key is transparency, accountability, and execution.
Well, yeah, I just have to applaud what you're doing, and I think we can't solve, you know, a solution cannot, you know, happen without having corporations involved. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Matt had mentioned this, but, you know, ExxonMobil Foundation has been involved and helped to seed NIMC. So corporations like those are really a part of the solution here. Carl, let me turn to NSBE. Mm-hmm. Your mission and strategic plan is to graduate 10,000 engineers annually by 2025. How are you going to do that, and how can the folks out here help you with that?
Well, thank you. And first of all, that was a moonshot for us as a society. Our mission is to increase the number of culturally responsible Black engineers who excel academically, succeed professionally, and positively impact the community. And when I came on as executive director 2.5 years ago, I said, you know, if we increase by one, will we have achieved our mission? Because I'm a numbers guy, too. And, so the National Executive Board really established 2 years ago a strategic plan to indeed, that's our moonshot, to nearly triple the number of Black engineers this country produces. The first step is really to quantify the extent of the challenge and the opportunity. Only 19% of African American fourth graders are proficient in math. Only 13% of them are proficient in math at the eighth grade level. Only 5.5% of African American children are taking calculus. And only 1.1% of that cohort are entering into engineering, and only 31% are graduating in 6 years with an engineering degree. And so we really set goals at each of those five different metrics. At the fourth grade level, getting to 28%. At the eighth grade level, getting to 23%. Doubling the number of those who are completing calculus, et cetera. So that's the first, is quantifying the goal, establishing the extent of it, and then deploying key programs at each of those levels. So in our audience here, Trina Fletcher leads our Summer Engineering Experience for Kids. It is our third to fifth grade program that increases proficiency in math, awareness, and interest in engineering for kids in 14 cities, 12 cities and 14 camps around the country. We had about 3,000 young people in that program. About 18,000 have participated since 2007. And we are scaling up with a National Science Foundation grant, thank you, Kamal and team, to 31 sites by 2019, affecting 28,000 young people that will be a part of that program. Our NSBE Junior programs, 125 chapters around the world, and many of them in this country, really expose and increase proficiency in math. Scholarship programs and partnerships with our corporate partners like Intel and others to increase the number of young people who have scholarships. Because if UNCF reported that $5,000 awarded to an African American freshman increases the likelihood that he or she will graduate in 5 years by 8 percentage points. So it's a small amount, produce a great deal of return. And then we're working with the 300 plus of ABET accredited colleges and universities and American Society for Engineering Education to produce toolkits to roll out on best practices that colleges and universities can employ to improve the success of those students. So there are a number of things that we're doing. Really, we need partners to scale up these programs, partners with other programs. I'm so thrilled that we're partnering with ACES, SWE, SHIP to multiply our 10K strategy with a 50K coalition, 43 engineering societies, colleges, and universities, to look to produce 50,000 diverse engineers annually by 2025 who are African American, Native American, women, and Latino. So we are looking for more to around this collective impact. We heard that today. looking for more to lead an effort to transform the face of engineering in this country.
Great. We applaud your work. Dr. Moses, I'm afraid to even ask you this question. No. Tell us a little bit more about the algebra project, but I think more importantly, why is this a civil rights issue? I heard someone mention that earlier. I'd like to hear your perspective.
So I was on the witness stand in the Federal District Court in Greenville in the spring of 1963. Right? We had taken sharecroppers down to register to vote in Greenwood. And Kennedy is still president. Bobby Kennedy's attorney general. Burke Marshall is the assistant attorney general for civil rights. He sued the city of Greenwood, and when the SNCC field secretaries were arrested, had our cases removed to the federal district court. So we busloaded sharecroppers over, filled up the courtroom. Burke sent John Doerr down to be our lawyer. The federal district judge Clayton leans over and he just has one question. Why is SNCC taking illiterates down to register to vote? So our basic answer is, well, the country can't have its cake and eat it too. It can't have denied access to literacy through its politics and then turn around and say, well, you can't do politics because you're illiterate, right? So at the end of that year, in December 1963, Judge Wisdom gave his decision on the U.S. v. Louisiana case. And he said, because of the history of Louisiana, we can no longer rely on the state of Louisiana to oversee voter registration. And that became part of the argument in the enforcement provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which has since been gutted by the Roberts administration. So when I think about where we are as a country now, vis-a-vis education, I think that we're in the same kind of position as we were 50 years ago, vis-a-vis the right to vote. We're in this standoff between the feds and the states, right? 400 Mexican Americans marched out of their schools in 1968 in San Antonio, marched on the school board, right? Their mothers took it to court. It ended up at the Supreme Court in 1973 in a case called San Antonio versus Rodriguez. So Chief Justice Powell said, look, you can't come to the federal system for equity relief because there is no substantive constitutional right to an education in this country, right? So if you look at where we are now, there are 45 equity cases in 45 states, right? And what I hear today is talk about aspirations, right? There's aspirational talk about what students are able to do and what they should achieve and what kind of education system we should have. If you look at the court cases, you look at Levitan in New York City, you look at the Campaign for Fiscal Equity in New York City, you look at all these cases that have followed on the Rodriguez decision, and they are talking about adequate, sound, basic education for people whose job is to serve on juries and vote, right? They are not talking about what you're talking about here. They are talking, and the further problem is that if they say, well, what is the state's legitimate interest in education and in terms of how they fund education, and they will say that the states has a legitimate interest in local control of education, that the local school boards and so forth cities control education. So that's where we were 50 years ago with the right to vote, right? It was states that controlled it, and how did they control it? They sent the control down to the local registrar, right? So every single registrar had the ability to say who could or who could not vote. And what the Justice Department found when they went in there was that if you were white and you breathed, you voted, right? And that was the basis for their saying that we need to do something now. So what do we need to do, right? What we need to do is to figure out how we get a constitutional floor around this issue for education. What the civil rights movement did was it shifted the conversation from state and feds to the right of the person, the citizen, right? So the Freedom Rider going through Alabama was not thinking they were a citizen of the state of Alabama. They were thinking they were a citizen of the country, and it meant something, right? So it's a shift from equal protection to the substantive citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, right? So Goodwin Liu, you guys from California, look at Goodwin Liu. He's on your Supreme Court out there. He's written an article called Education, Equity, and National Citizenship in the Yale Law School Journal. He's laying out the argument that it's the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment that we should be working, that we need a movement in this country that says that every single person in this country has a constitutional right, right? For purposes of our education, we are citizens of states, right? We can be citizens of this country to go fight, but for purposes of getting school, we're citizens of states. We need to also be citizens of our country for purposes of our education. You're talking about funding. We're not going to have any funding if the funding is just from the states and the local communities. They don't have any money, mm-hmm. right? It's the feds. We need a national tax on education.
Well, Dr. Moses, I if you guys would help me, let's give him a hand. Thank you for your vigilance on this issue, and it's certainly important during these times that we're in. I have a whole list of questions which I'm not going to answer, but I would like to open up for questions from the audience. So if those of you are interested, I knew that was going to happen.
We thought everybody had to go to a bathroom break.
Did you say a bathroom break?
Give us 10 minutes for questions, all right? So let's go here.
Hi, my name is Giovanna Guerrero Medina. I'm the director of Ciencia Puerto Rico, which is a network that gathers over 7,500 people around the world who are interested in science in Puerto Rico and moving forward STEM education and careers. As we're having this amazing, very inspiring set of talks, I got pulled into a little bit of a Twitter war from somebody that said, women don't go into CS because they're not interested. You know, they don't want to sit in front of computers all day. And I've heard similar comments even from people from my community saying, oh, Puerto Ricans are not interested in science, when I have over 7,500 people from Puerto Rico who are interested in science. So my question is, as we are thinking about how to move STEM education forward for everybody, and we're thinking about how we can do it from the bottom up, should we also be considering strategies from the top down to help everybody understand how this is a priority for the country? And you know, how can we engage leaders in our communities and in the nation to help us move this along? Thank you.
So I'll be glad to help with that, because I was blessed enough to be on a board for Puerto Rico from NSF for 5 years, and it was focused on computing. And I would say that Puerto Rico had a really great example of pre-college program, still do today, that basically exposes young people to research early. I'm talking about middle school.
I was fascinated and actually very successful in recruiting a number of students from that community, that island. The students there basically have a natural curiosity and want to basically enrich their lives, very much so. And it's very, very impressive to see the young people. I've had a young student, female, that you're talking about, basically as a senior in my own home. And basically, she's now at Columbia getting her PhD in computational linguistics. So I am very proud that we were able to expose to her how I think exposure is part of that key. You have to expose more of the students and the community and the leaders to what is going on and how they can basically have an impact. Without that leadership basically being exposed to it as well, then you pretty much, it's going to be hard because they're just throwing money at it for the most part. But you have to actually get them engaged and get them involved in it as well. And so that's what we were able to do, is get more leaders involved.
Sorry, Tony. I want to get to as many questions as we can, so please, questioners, just go to the question. We love your program, but if you would just give us the question, and then if we can keep our answers short. Yeah. Next.
My program will remain a mystery to you, but let me ask this question. So I was thrilled to hear Barbara say we need to fix the system and not the students. And as a social scientist, I talk to a lot of students who are alienated by STEM, and the natural tendency is to dismiss that as ignorance or misinformation when they say that STEM is the enemy. But I think they're right. I think if you look at the fact that now 1% of the population on Earth owns 50% of the wealth, that global warming is being created by the energy industry, pesticide poisoning is being created by the chemistry industry, obesity is being created by the food science industry.
Okay, question.
STEM is a problem, and we need STEM inclusion to be part of a transformative approach to STEM, not just a sameness approach. So I wanted to hear folks say something about a transformative approach to STEM education.
Yeah, I'll take a pass at it. Not sure that I'm 100% clear on your question, but so let me just say two things. So what would it take to get students more interested in STEM and feel more inclusive about STEM and alleviate the baggage that's associated with the STEM stereotypes? Is that your question?
Good way to put it.
Okay. So it's complicated in Facebook language. So this is a very complicated thing because you're dealing with systems and root cause analysis, and there are multiple root causes. So simple things that we can do by, and what we're doing in Oakland. First, we started with parent education, because they are a critical part of this ecosystem. For my Native American project that we have, we started with the community leaders and the tribal leaders because we needed their advocacy and buy-in. So first you need to understand the system, and then as true engineers would, because my background is electrical engineering, that's the beautiful thing about Intel is they put engineers on these challenges. You need to talk to the students. No company would try and design a product without having conversations or listening sessions with the end user. This challenge, while people try and say it's complicated because it's human, and it is that, but you need to also get the voice of the young people. So for example, our kids, they told us in Oakland and also my science fairs that we, the community, don't care about STEM. We prefer the football games, and they follow the money. The students, 13 to 18-year-old kids, they told me about all of you in this room. They said that you'll spend the money on the games, but their teacher has to spend the money on the math challenges. My sister is a math teacher. You know what? Fortunately, it's 8 of us. We each had to buy iPads for every single student in her class. So we should stop shifting the blame to the students and own our own individual accountability. And I think we can each find a place in that as a parent, as a community citizen, as an individual, and as an Intel employee.
I think we have time for, unfortunately, one more question. Okay. And I'm going to take the moderator.
Hi, I'm Dr. Noreen Cohn-Mayberry, founder of Nicole's Garden. What we do is we take space education and we put it in the STEM environment. And full disclosure, I do work for NASA, but I'm not here representing NASA today. My question is, I think that the conversation kind of needs to change in terms of creating people who are in decision-making authority, because you could, it's wonderful to have a PhD, master's in STEM, engineering, science, but if you're not in an in a position of making a decision, a hiring authority, then you can't really help anyone else. So when I hear about attainment, I hear about retention, what are we doing to create people who know how to create their own businesses that are in STEM so they can hire people who look like them? And what are we doing in these corporations? It's great to increase your numbers of, you know, minorities in STEM, but if they can't hire anyone else that looks like them, then they are frustrated and it becomes very career limiting. So what are we doing? What can we do to change that?
So who wants to take that? Don't talk yet. Okay, all right. Let me ask the young lady that's right next to you to ask her question. She's, I'd like to hear from a young person in this audience, please. So we're gonna answer two questions.
Okay, so I'm a junior at Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology. And so it's STEM magnet school in Northern Virginia. And so I wanted to ask a question related to the kind of environment that we have at TJ. And so we have an environment, I guess, of innovation, and like all of our teachers are STEM professionals who come back to teach. I have a few teachers who graduated from TJ, went on to have jobs in industry and come back to teach. And so it's that kind of environment that we have that promotes like innovative thinking and moving forward in that field. So I wanted to add, I also have a nonprofit organization that was kind of born out of that innovative spirit that I got at TJ. And so we do workshops at kind of one school in our area. And so I wanted to ask, how do you make STEM like cool for the kids? Because one of the workshops that we went to was a middle school girl, and they were really interested in playing on their phones, right? But then once you grab their interest and say, like, you can make your own game if you learn how to code, it's like grabbing that interest. So how would you suppose grabbing that type of interest?
Okay. Thank you, young lady. Tony, take the first question, and then Carl's going to take hers.
So the first question was introducing entrepreneurship.
Absolutely.
Right?
We need to do more business training along
yeah.
with science.
So totally agree with that. And there is a number of programs that are basically being done, United Negro College Fund and some others. But all of the school programs that you kind of heard, they're also teaching these young people actually how to do entrepreneurship as well. I know our lab, for example, we are actually teaching our researchers actually how to be entrepreneurs. And then wonderful programs at DOE have started out of Director Harris's office as well, is really reaching out to some of the historically black colleges, MSUs, so forth and so on, and we're bringing a cohort of students together that are on their graduate track to have them better educate themselves about entrepreneurship and innovation. Our labs are basically innovation facilities, and as a result of that, natural incubators that basically people can generate ideas. And what we want to do is share that with others and teach them how to actually be those innovators. So we're teaching it all the way from college all the way down to middle school.
But is it happening in the schools? Because at the HBCUs,
so
hang on,
that's unfair.
So in partnership with the HBCUs, yes.
That's correct.
So yes, okay. It is happening, and they're built on consortium models to basically make it happen. NSF has done this, and some of the other organizations as well to try and help this. You know, like he said, Dr. Bob said, it's research oriented, but what we do is implement other things that we can actually pull together to help people generate ideas a little bit more.
Carl.
Yeah, and I would just say I was involved when I was with the UNCF to, that helped to launch that the innovation commercialization entrepreneurship effort that Dr. Chad Womack is leading with HBCUs and Silicon Valley. So it is indeed happening. I see it pushed down. We also have a special interest group around entrepreneurship in NSBE, and so that's the major goal of that effort. In terms of your question about making it exciting and fun, You know, science is everywhere. I think I heard Dr. Mae Jamison and others say this earlier today, and that is, it's just ubiquitous everywhere we went. So when I was at MIT, I was running the engineering outreach program. I think still the greatest team in baseball history, the Boston Red Sox, was doing very
no,
well.
No.
Although Theo Epstein is now the general manager of the Cubs. So anyway,
thank you.
But baseball was so ubiquitous, it's everywhere. And Moneyball, the book by Michael Lewis, just came out and looked at cybermetrics and others and ways to approach and baseball from a scientific point of view. And so we started a program there called the Science of Baseball, 4 weeks for eighth grade, and that it started out with boys, and then we expanded it to girls as well, to really teach the math and science as associated with baseball. So they learned every week there was a focus on a different skill, hitting, pitching, running, and throwing, and they learned the math and science taught by college students who are baseball players. And then in the afternoon, they got to scrimmage. It was a 4-week summer program in that initiative. I actually learned from Dr. Moses the algebra project and applied another program using his experiential learning model from the algebra project, which turns education on its head, starts with a demonstration, and we installed a Saturday engineering academy for young people. The focus was on the disciplines of engineering, and they learned the underlying math and science behind it. So you don't lead with the math and science. It basically is theory through the lens of practice. And a lot of people are tactical. I think I heard Kamal Bob and others talk about just the need for practical learning. Just making it relevant, rooting it in the interest of the younger person, and then parlaying that interest into teach the math and science. It gives context for why am I learning. We talk about Generation X and Generation Y. I like to call everybody, and mostly around these young people, the Generation Y, W-H-Y. Not Y's, but Y. Because the focus here is why am I doing this? They really have to understand the context. And we kind of go into probably usually a chapter two before starting with the introduction and the very beginning to understand and explain the why. And I think that's how you do it. One more quick thing. I've got a good friend who's a professor at Olin College, and she was approached by a blind person with a walking stick and said, can we do something to make these walking sticks smart? And so they're really designing sensors in the walking stick with that allow them to communicate with a smartphone with an earpiece so that they communicate exactly what that walking stick's seeing. Yeah. And it makes so much sense, and she's able to draw tons of young people into that class around science because we're solving a problem that is relevant and important.
Can I add just one really super quick end note here? Just really quick here. What all this speaks to is we hire faculty, I'm thinking from a college context, who really aren't prepared to work with our students, right? We need intensive, ongoing professional development for them, because what people do is they typically teach how they were taught. And how they were taught is typically not how our students learn.
Correct.
So we have to do a better job in doing that. We also have to do a better job in hiring the right people. Typically what we do is we ask a diversity question. Can you tell me about your experiences in working with diverse student populations? Well, that only tells you about their exposure to diversity. A Teach for America student might be able to respond to that, Dr. Moses. But it'll tell you about their... It'll tell you about their exposure, but not about their commitment. So we have to do a better job about asking the right questions so we can get the right people at the table. Thank you.
Let's give the panel.
Thanks, please.
Thank you, Dr. Harris, and to all of our panelists. I think my goal here today was to bring from across the country leaders, and I think from the feel of the room with everyone kind of wanting to add to the discussion, we really accomplished that. So just to let you guys know, all of these folks will be in, or most of these folks will be in your breakout sessions. The real goal was to craft a day where you did have, we're going to go into an hour of lunch and networking, and then 2 hours of smaller breakout discussions where you will get to connect with one another and connect with the great folks up here. So all of your voices will be heard today.